Chapter 2 Gorm sought comfort in a small alcove on the glen's ruined ramparts. The nook provided a dry patch of ground, a modicum of shelter from the frigid wind, and a truly impressive view. The high walls rose all around him, their icy peaks towering over the vale below. The dwarf rummaged around in his old rucksack, his nose wrinkling at the odors of cigarette smoke and wet kobold. Beneath Bert's personal effects and his own supplies, a thick leather packet was bound with thin black rope. He unpacked it slowly, taking care not to spill the Heartseeker beads. The small stones were inert in his palm, their magic long dormant. The beads were enchanted to orient toward the Gizvarda tribe whenever one of them gripped the Heartstone. Nobody had gripped the stone in months, and now they were little more than a memento of the goblin whose grave he had taken them from. There was too much to do to mourn Tibrin again. Gorm packed the beads up, set them aside, and pulled an old book from the packet. Sheltering the pages from the wind, Gorm opened the collected works and notes of Niln of Almatra. His calloused fingers traced the edges of the worn leather journal. The ragged book reminded him of the thin scribe who penned it, both a wise man and a fool boy. He smiled at the thought of the priest.
"Let's see if you can offer any insight today, Niln," he muttered to himself.
Gorm began to read. "And I saw a bird, or maybe three, or maybe one that burned three times. He was a babe, and then a beast, and then a dark king rising in blood. The Maiden of Tears loves him, fears him, mourns him. Her tears end, the vessel fills, once more rises the traitor god."
"Totally barmy," murmured Gorm,
though he wore a fond smile as he said it. The passage was from the Prophet Rebek's first and most coherent book. According to Niln's commentary in the margin, the first book of Rebek was completed just before the ancient scribe descended into the madness that claimed most of Almatra's chosen. After his breakdown, the prophet's writing turned exclusively to sonnets addressed to various species of caterpillar. The margins of the scriptures overflowed with notes and cross-references, all written in a neat, tight script. Niln had studied every passage in great detail, slicing each verse into discrete parts for examination, as a naturalist might dissect a frog. This particular passage had clearly puzzled the late High Scribe of Almatra.
"A burning bird is a phoenix. Does it represent the Dark Prince as he resurrects Alfadden? But where are the seven heroes? Is this a vision of what is to come, or a vision of the world if the heroes fail? If the prince is destined to bring back the Sten, whence hope? If the heroes are destined to stop him, whence this prophecy?"
"Ye never could make any sense of this claptrap either, could ye?"
The dwarf traced the text with the tip of his finger. After Niln's death, the scribe's scriptures and notes were all that he had of his old friend. It wasn't much, but it was enough to remind Gorm of why he was out here. When he felt hopeless, when aimlessness threatened to extinguish the fire at his core, it helped to remember Tibrin's courage and Niln's faith, and the slimy bastards who brought both of them to untimely ends. Gorm's grip tightened on the page as he exhaled a ragged breath.
"Ye two are the only things keeping me going,"
he grumbled, tracing his finger down the page. As he did so, his finger passed a hastily scrawled comment in the margins, the ink smeared in careless urgency.
"This cannot be accomplished by mortal hands, least of all by mine." Margwise, chapter 3, verse 3.
The dwarf was still considering the scrawled note when a large rock hit the side of the fortress with a crack and a thud. He stared at the stone for a moment before he carefully closed the book and placed it within the leather parcel. A second rock hit the ramparts as he tucked the package back in his rucksack.
"I'm coming,"
Gorm grumbled as he stepped up to the edge of the ramparts and peered over the edge. Below him, atop the narrow ribbon of rock between the fortress wall and the jagged slopes of the high walls, perched a hulking figure with a grin full of daggers. Gorm smiled, which was an unusual reaction to the arrival of a troll. Thane, however, had proven himself to be unlike other trolls in many important ways, most notably that he would interact with people without trying to kill them.
"Anything to report?"
asked Gorm, clambering down from a trail of rubble and stones. Thane shook his head.
"Nothing to speak of."
Gorm nodded. The monsters and villains that threatened the party came in two varieties, those that could detect a troll well enough to steer clear of Thane, and those that quickly came to wish that they could.
"Come over here,"
the troll urged, ushering Gorm around a piece of jutting granite that reinforced the fort's wall.
"We're still visible from the gate."
Gorm looked at the tapering pass around the jutting stone and the sheer drop on the other side of it.
"I can't believe we're still going through all this effort to keep you hidden,"
he grumbled as he navigated around the ridge to privacy.
"You know I still can't show myself,"
Thane said.
"Why not?"
Gorm barked. He always felt a little off balance in talks about relationships, and the edge of a cliff was a bad place to be off balance.
"She knows you're there. She still stares out of camp at night. I hear her trying to talk to you when she thinks nobody's listening. She can tell you're watching over us, Thane." "She knows something is watching over you," Thane countered, "but to her, I am the king in the wood. I am still as she imagines me to be."
The troll looked at his gnarled, hairy hands.
"I doubt she'd be as happy with the truth."
"Stranger things have happened."
"Probably not many of them,"
countered Thane. Gorm shrugged.
"If a troll can get all loopy over an elf, I don't see why it can't be the other way around." "Unfortunately, I can think of a few reasons," said Thane.
He attempted to give Gorm a warm smile and managed to not look too menacing.
"Perhaps I'll show myself someday, but for now, keep my secret."
"I will," said Gorm.
He looked out over the crags of the high walls and the baroque shadows they cast in the afternoon sun.
"But I don't like it. How long are things between you going to be this way? We've been traveling together for over a year."
"It's been a rough year," said Thane. "There wasn't really a good time."
"There's never a good time to say you've been keeping a big secret."
"Some times are worse than others,"
the troll countered.
"Aye, but we don't have forever to choose from," said Gorm. "Parties of heroes don't stay together this long without a quest. Something always starts a fight, be it a spat over the best loot or a full-blown feud for party leadership. Fights become rifts, and then the party splits in two or three, or falls apart altogether."
"Surely it's not always like that,"
Thane said.
"It is often enough," said Gorm. "And that's assuming you're on someone's payroll. We've been hunted like dogs by the guild, and even Bert is talking about the good old days of living in some poncy elf's purse. Nobody's left yet, but it wouldn't take much."
"But after all you've been through together," said Thane, "what of loyalty and friendship?"
"Not to put a tarnish on friendship, but a party of professional heroes is a group of well-paid killers for hire," said Gorm. "Every one of 'em's got their own agenda, their own dark past. And when all the secrets start coming to light, parties split, and we can't split the party."
"You're not like that,"
insisted the troll.
"Perhaps. We're a bit lighter on the killing, and we definitely ain't well paid," Gorm said. "But long-kept secrets still have ways of doing damage."
"You're worried that I'll divide them,"
said Thane, staring over the horizon.
"Party's already divided in a way," said Gorm. "There's those of us who know you're a part of it, and those that don't. That's a crack in the armor. Folks are already grumbling. The past year we've all been cold, hungry, and miserable, and they're starting to question why we're even out here chasing after the Guzvarda when there ain't a shadowkin on Arth who doesn't hate us. The whole party's like a tinderbox next to the fire. They catch me and Bert keeping ye from them. Well, it'd be a big spark if you catch my drift."
"I see,"
said the troll.
"An introduction, though."
"That might go better," Gorm suggested.
"I'll think on it,"
Thane said.
"Good. Things can't go on as they have been forever."
Gorm let out a long sigh at the admission.
"And on that note, I suppose I'd best get back to the party and give them the news."
The troll raised a curious eyebrow.
"The news?"
"Aye."
Gorm looked across the valley below the glens to the distant forest and grasslands of southern Ruskin.
"We're going south."
It seemed to Poldo that his situation was quickly deteriorating. Moments after bowling him over, his furry assailant pinned the Scribkin's arm behind his back and dragged him behind one of Boulderfolk's ornate dumpsters. Small claws pressed into his cheeks as a hand, or perhaps a paw, pressed over his mouth. He attempted to speak, but the attacker twisted his arm even further behind his back. Poldo let out a muffled whimper instead.
"Quiet,"
growled a somewhat feminine voice, or else.
Another bout of shouting rang through the alleyway.
Where are you, mongrel? Bellowed a furious voice. If I see you or your filthy kin in my alley again, I'll call the guild. They know what to do with your kind.
Poldo heard the muffled commotion of someone kicking boxes, and then heavy, receding footsteps. A door slammed in the distance, leaving the Scribkin alone in the dark with his assailant. After a few minutes, she loosed her grip on his face.
Madam, I don't want any trouble.
Poldo's mouth forged ahead while his brain ran in panicked circles.
Nobody ever wants any trouble, said the attacker, but we've both stepped in it now. Perhaps, but violence is never an acceptable answer, and there may be benefits to releasing me. I never said anything about hurting anyone.
Poldo's assailant tried to interrupt.
I just need a moment to think.
She didn't get one. Poldo's speech poured out in a continuous, nearly hysterical stream.
Monetary or otherwise, I am a gnome of some means, you see, and if you do not harm me, I am sure I can make it worth your while. My name is Dwin Poldo, and I...
Poldo? She started at his name.
Yes, I have an office at Boulderfolk, which may tell you what kind of money we are dealing with. Mr. Poldo of Golds and Bags? Although not as much as one might expect. What? Well, formerly of Golds and Bags Group, yes, said Poldo. I resigned a bit over a year ago, and in the meantime, I...
His attacker's demeanor brightened at the admission. She released his arm and spun him around, revealing a knoll so thin that she looked almost skeletal. She wore a motley collection of old rags that covered little of her fur, and the fur that showed was covered in mange. She covered her ears and much of her face with a headscarf fashioned from an old towel, though the fox-like muzzle protruding from the head wrap was clearly smiling.
Mr. Poldo, you used to work with my husband. My name is Feister Herc. Mr. Herc? Ah, yes, I remember, said Poldo, recalling the knoll attendant. He ran the lift in Goldsenbag's central office.
Mrs. Herc's eyes lit up.
Yes, and he talked about you all the time. He was always going on about kind Mr. Poldo. He thought the world of you. Did he?
Poldo liked Herc well enough, and had regretted that the knoll quit after the incident with the Gisvarda tribe.
Yet the Scribkin didn't recall being especially close to the lift operator. Oh, yes. It seems like every day he'd mention you. Mr. Poldo said hello again today. Mr. Poldo gave me a copper for a tip this evening. Or, why can't they all be like Mr. Poldo? He's never kicked me once. Wait. Surely people never kicked Mr. Herc?
Poldo said, his apprehension draining away in his confusion.
Yeah,
said Mrs. Herc sadly.
Very often, whenever they were having bad luck, it seemed. They had an expression for it. What? They never said anything like that to...
A memory sparked in Poldo's mind.
Oh, you mean kicking the dog?
The gnoll's face seemed to become a little more brittle.
That's the one, she said. But that was just an expression,
said Poldo.
You know, when Urgrum or Briggs or one of the lads in sales couldn't get to their numbers, they'd say, I just need to kick the dog. And then they'd step out for a break and...
Somewhere in Poldo's mind, a wall fell, and his stomach twisted when he saw the other side.
Oh, gods, he said. They were actually kicking someone? Usually not that hard, said Mrs. Herc kindly. And you never did. I think that's why he was always saying how nice Mr. Poldo is. Or you are. Ah, good.
Poldo felt like he had ingested something greasy. It was disturbing that he was remembered for only the slightest of courtesies, and all the more so that those slight courtesies still exceeded the average.
Where is Mr. Herc now, anyways?
Mrs. Herc's eyes fell, and her tail drooped.
Oh, he's gone. Surely not dead?
Gasped Poldo.
His papers were revoked for criminal activity,
sighed Mrs. Herc, her tail tucked beneath her legs.
So the guild, well, they did what they do. But how?
Asked Poldo.
We were hungry, and I sent Mr. Herc to sneak out to the baker shop. They voided Herc's papers and killed him for stealing bread for his family? Cried Poldo. Oh, no, Mr. Poldo.
The gnoll was equally appalled by the notion. The Scribkin shook his head.
Oh, well, for a moment he bought the bread, of course. We don't steal.
The last words came out in a snarl, and Mrs. Herc's eyes burned. For a moment, Poldo's mind flashed back to when he was a young boy in his family workshop, when his father had sat him down and told him that, if nothing else, he could take pride in being a good person. Since then, he'd discovered that being a good person was the last resort of self-esteem. In the upper echelons of Andoran's financial industry, people prided themselves on the name of the firm they worked for, the size of the deals they closed, the title on their business card, and anything else that could be quickly boiled down to a sum of gold. With so much to take pride in beyond integrity, many bankers put little stock in it. Yet, standing behind a dumpster and clad in filthy rags, Mrs. Rourke clung to her morals like a terrier to a postman's heel.
"I meant no offense, madam, but if I may, if not stealing, why were his papers revoked?"
"Oh, he jaywalked on his way home."
"What?"
"Yes, he was hurrying back, but the law says he should have used the crosswalk. So the heroes took his papers, and then—"
Mrs. Herc's voice caught in her throat.
"I'm so sorry,"
whispered Poldo.
"They took the bread, and the rest of our money as well."
Mrs. Rourke took a moment to wipe her eyes.
"But we get by. I can take as much food as I need from the dumpsters up here as long as I'm not seen. And Mr. Rourke lost his papers, but we still have ours."
Poldo was still reeling from the story of Herc's demise, so it took a moment for the Knoll's last words to register.
"Excuse me, did you say we?"
The dumpster next to them suddenly rattled and shook. The lid lifted up just enough to allow three tiny snouts to pop out from the gap. Behind them, three pairs of eyes sparkled in the darkness.
"Mama," the pups cried, "did you bring food?"
"Hush, children, that wasn't the signal," said Mrs. Rourke. "I'm talking to Mr. Poldo."
"But we're cold, Mama,"
whined a young Knoll.
"It's warmer under the trash, my dears," said Mrs. Rourke.
"But we're hungry, too,"
said another pup. Mrs. Rourke gave Poldo an embarrassed nod as she stepped over to address the dumpster.
"I couldn't get any food today. Maybe tomorrow," she hissed to the pups from the side of her muzzle. "But there's plenty of cans and bottles to lick in there. That will tide you over."
"But I cuff my tongue, Mama,"
whined one of the pups. Poldo staggered back under the weight of the guilt pressing in. His old colleague's widow and her children were starving, and Poldo hadn't even realized Rourke had died. No, not died. Herc had been murdered by the industry that gave Poldo his fortune. He felt like the air was being crushed from his lungs. Mrs. Herc must have noticed his wheezing.
"I'm sorry," she said. "Rex, close the dumpster. The smell is bothering poor Mr. Poldo."
"No. No, it's not the smell,"
gasped Poldo, struggling to compose himself.
"Well, you don't look well," said Mrs. Herc. "Do you need to leave? If you need to leave, can you please promise not to tell anyone we're staying here? If they find out I'm trespassing, they'll take our papers."
"You cannot live in the trash,"
Poldo managed to say. "Please, Mr. Poldo."
Fear crept into Mrs. Herc's voice.
"If not for us, do it for Mr. Herc."
"You misunderstand me, madam," said Poldo. "You must come with me. We'll get you some food for a start. I believe there's a cart that sells 10-penny beef rolls in the park down the street."
"Buying us beef rolls?"
the Knoll asked, clearly perplexed.
"For a start," said Poldo firmly. "Afterward, we'll see about some clothes, and then we'll discuss what comes next."
"Mr. Poldo," said Mrs. Rourke, "please, you don't have to do all of that."
Poldo looked up at the children peering curiously out of the dumpster, and in their faces he saw the features of a kind lift attendant who apparently thought the world of any manager who gave him as much respect as a wall fixture.
"But I must, Mrs. Rourke. I truly must."
Truth and free will were usually the domain of Arth's philosophers and priests, who liked to focus on the big questions. The scientists of Arth, by contrast, dedicated themselves to the smaller but more immediately useful questions, or at least the quickly profitable, especially if you're not too stodgy about ethics, questions. Yet for millennia, Arth's gnomes maintained a tradition of philosopher-scientists, high-minded individuals who sought to comprehend the essential nature of being, to answer the deepest mysteries of the universe, and to wrestle those truths into mathematical equations. Greatest among them was the fifth-age philosopher-scientist Nove, best known for his work on expectations and reality. Nove's research posited that reality is partially comprised of irony in its various forms. The exact ratio of irony to matter in the universe is known as Nove's constant, and by definition it's more than you'd expect. It's well established that expectations and timing shape perception, and the perception shapes reality. But it was Nove who originally inverted these ideas to posit that perception and expectations could change the timing of events. His first principle of universal irony was expressed as a long formula that involves Nove's constant, the number of people sharing an understanding, and the amount of time in which an event disturbing that understanding would be surprising. For the common layperson, however, it was easier to remember that the universe had a nasty sense of timing, and it was best not to voice certain thoughts out loud. People avoided statements like, "It can't be that bad," "Just one probably won't hurt," or, "Well, the native population's been drinking it for centuries, and they don't seem to mind it." While skeptics were quick to point out that a reasonable person would hardly expect a turn of phrase to alter the course of fate, proponents of Nove's work were equally quick to note that was exactly the problem. Thus it was that Gorm's party was embroiled in controversy as they trudged through the ruined gates of the glens. "All I said was that things are looking up," snapped Jin.
"Yes, and now you keep saying it," Haraldin growled.
The ancient headless skeleton pinned to the glen's wall rattled in an unfelt wind as he stepped out of the fortress.
"Have you never heard of the philosopher Nove?"
"I've heard of him, read his work, and seen it debunked." "And even if it was true," Jin spoke up to head off any argument, "the fact remains that his teachings are impractical to the point of uselessness. It's impossible to avoid saying everything that might ironically precede an event."
"You can reduce your chances," said Katha. "You just have to speak a little more carefully."
"Why?" demanded the wizard, stopping at the edge of the ruined gate.
"It took us weeks to convince Gorm to head south. Do you think poor wording will alter our course at this point?"
"Gods," said Katha, "there you go again.
Perhaps if you stopped saying things like that, we'll have the pleasure of not finding out," snapped Haraldin.
Gaist nodded.
"Are we all really that superstitious?"
Jin stared at the other heroes in turn.
"Yes, all living in the prior age? Very well, I'll speak no more."
"Thank you," said Haraldin.
The wizard shook his head.
"All I really meant to say is that anybody would be glad to be leaving these mountains and this God's forsaken fort. I'm sure all the poor souls manning the walls would agree if they weren't ashes at the bottom of the orcs' pyres."
"Well, they're not ashes."
Bert stuck his head out from Gorm's rucksack.
"What?" said Haraldin.
"He said they were ashes," said the kobold with a shrug. "But the thing about orcish pyres is that they're for orcs. They don't burn their enemies."
Jin scratched his beards. "Fine. The goblin pyres."
"Goblins and kobolds don't burn their enemies either," said Bert. "Least, not after they're dead. I know the Stoneblood tribe likes to use flaming arrows and burning oil traps."
"None of ye shadow can burn your foes?" Gorm asked.
"Of course not," said Bert. "We leave them intact for their families to come back and take care of. I mean, after we nick some skulls and teeth for trophies, mind."
"You expect the widows and widowers and orphans to come back right after you killed everyone in the area and mutilated their corpses?" said Laruna.
"Well, yeah."
The kobold was getting a bit defensive.
"It's not like we'd hurt them or anything while they're burying the dead."
The Solomancer shook her head.
"How would they know that?"
"I don't know."
Bert's hackles were up.
"We all just know, all right? It's culture, shared experience and all that. You don't burn other people's dead. There are no lightlings in those pyres.
Well, then, where are the bodies? Wondered Heraldin. Gorm whirled around, prompting a yelp of protest from the kobold on his back.
Wait, you didn't find the remains of any defenders?
Heraldin held his hands out. Did you see any corpses lying around the courtyard?
No, but I was searching out here, said Gorm. I thought you found them tucked away in a back room or something.
Did you really think the Red Horde tidies up and tucks away the dead in a back room? Jin asked. Maybe they swept and dusted on their way out, too?
Or the defenders made a desperate last stand in the keep, snapped Gorm.
It doesn't really matter, said Caitha. The problem is, there aren't any bodies around.
An unpleasant silence fell over the party. Gorm felt a chill run up his spine as he stood in the still mountain air.
Also, he said slowly, there ain't any wind.
Right, said Heraldin.
If there ain't any wind, what's making them bones move?
Said Gorm, pointing. The heroes turned to the rattling skeleton hanging from the gate. The bones twitched and shook as though blown by a breeze that wasn't there, or perhaps as though trying to extricate the spear pinning it to the wall without the benefit of arms.
It wants to get down, said Caitha.
But where does it want to go? Asked Jin.
I know one way to find out, said Gorm.
He signaled to Geist, who reached up with a thick arm and yanked the spear from the stone. The headless skeleton dropped to the ground and crumpled into a pile of bones, then immediately set about the laborious process of righting itself. Upon regaining its footing, it hopped up and down a couple of times, as if testing its legs, and set off at a brisk march down the mountain path.
I have a bad feeling about this, said Heraldin.
You have a bad feeling about everything, Gorm replied.
And I'm usually right, said the bard, watching the bones jaunt away.
It might be warranted in this case, Laruna said. We don't know where the skeleton is going.
There's still only one way to find out,
Gorm adjusted his rucksack. I'd actually suggest that we don't want to be wherever the walking dead go, said Heraldin.
What I want is to know what's got a set of old bones so lively, said Gorm. Could be a simple haunting, but it could be much worse.
Whatever it is, if there's a serious undead threat nearby, it's best to know about it, agreed Caitha, even if for no other reason than to avoid it.
The dwarf nodded.
Or warn nearby towns.
Now hang on, this isn't what we discussed, protested the bard.
Sure it is. We said we'd help people if they need it. We're open to new paths, after all. Saving innocence is a passion, right?
Gorm set off down the path after the skeleton.
Come on, them bones are moving faster than they should be.
They shouldn't be moving at all, Heraldin called after his back. That's the problem.
Jin stepped up next to the bard. For the record, I'd like to say this was a coincidence. Noted, said Heraldin. Let the record also show that you were supposed to stop talking. The wizard's lips pulled into a thin line as he started off.
At least it's heading south, said Laruna. For all we know, the skeleton will take us closer to the high coast anyway.
Oof, said Caitha, clutching her belly as she jogged to catch up.
I wouldn't have eaten so much if I'd known I was going to head out on a run right away.
You didn't eat much at all, said Laruna.
Yeah, said Caitha, but I'm still regretting those last couple bites of stew.
I regretted the first one, Jin muttered, as the party followed the skeleton away from the glens.
Ha! Leaves a bad taste in one's mouth, doesn't it, sire?
Laughed Johann the Mighty, champion of Tandos. The paladin's ornate golden armor shimmered in the lantern light, and one of his hands rested easily on the hilt of a massive sword. The other gauntlet held a small, fluted glass filled with yellow-green liquid. Handor set his own drink down and tried to maintain his composure as the foulness bubbled down his throat.
What was that, by the bones?
He asked once he could convince his tongue to move again.
A terrapin topspin, Majesty, said the waiter. Shall I bring you something else?
I should think not.
Handor wiped his tongue with a napkin.
I doubt I could survive another one of your excursions to the bar.
The waiter blanched and hurried on to the other linen-lined tables in the room.
I tell you, Johann, it's amazing what people will subject themselves to.
The king's mouth twisted into an involuntary grimace as he eyed the paladins, Terrapin Topspin.
Ha! Right you are, sire. Case in point,
Johann waved out across the assembly. Colorful sprites danced amid the lanterns hanging from the rafters of the Temple of Tandos feasting hall. The great expanse was decorated with all the trappings of a ballroom. Andoran's elite had come out in force, wearing their finest suits and most impressive hats. Banners dangling over the affair bore the name and emblem of the Freedlands Blightworm Foundation. Indeed, Handor popped a trout pastry into his mouth.
Gods, the things we'll do for charity.
At least this is to eradicate Blightworm.
Or save it, said the paladin. The pamphlet's never quite clear.
I thought Blightworm was a wasting disease.
Yes, caused by a parasite of the same name. Perhaps it's endangered, or maybe they want it that way.
The paladin shook his head. I'm never sure what we're supporting.
That's how the foundations like things, grumbled the king. A banquet here, a cocktail hour there, donations every which way. It's all a lot of chances to rub elbows and talk business, and nobody ever knows enough about the problem to tell if they're solving it.
Ha! Well, on that note, it is a good place to talk, said Johann. We're to meet in the vestry by the southern apse. Shall we do the rounds?
I suppose we must.
Handor nodded, and with a deep breath launched himself into the tide of people who were both important and self-important to varying degrees. Nobles, executives, heroes, merchants, traders, guild leaders, and more. The evening became a whirlwind of shaking hands, exchanging pleasantries, expressing sympathies, and making excuses to dart on to the next guest. It was late by the time he and Johann extricated themselves from the gala, and made their way down the winding stone passages of Tando's temple to a small room. Johann knocked three times at the door, then kicked it in.
Ha-ha! Hello, fellows!
Fenrir Goldson, Bulby Bags, and Weaver Ortson were seated around a small table that had several bottles and glasses scattered over it. They inclined their heads in deference and held drinks up in salute as Handor entered.
What's on the agenda tonight? The king asked. Aside from a real drink, I mean. We're to report on revenue from heroic activities around Shadowkin Dens, Majesty.
Fenrir Goldson poured out a finger of rum and handed the tumbler to Handor. The ancient dwarf held up a small ledger bound in dark leather.
Shall we go over the figures?
They're very good, sire,
chimed in Weaver Ortson, raising his glass into the air. As Grand Master of the Heroes Guild, Ortson's analysis of heroic activities were invariably optimistic, and all the more so while he was sampling this year's vintages.
Let's start there, said Handor, settling back in a yew and velvet chair as Goldson read a litany of sums and percentages.
Things were generally looking up, especially stock prices on the wall, which explained the broad grins on the faces of the other occupants of the small, dimly lit room. Long ago, before Handor graduated from prince to king, he had imagined ruling as mostly sitting on a throne and making wise-sounding proclamations. Now that Handor was old enough to possess some wisdom, he realized that wise-sounding proclamations were for pacifying the masses. The actual business of ruling was exactly that. Business. Revenues and expenses, inflows and outflows, policies and addendums, and all of it done in smoke-filled rooms far from prying eyes and listening ears. Things had been done that way for generations when Handor took the throne, and the only change he'd made to the process was a partially successful effort to cut down on the smoke. When he'd heard enough about loot appraisals and plunder fund dividends, he raised a hand to silence Goldson.
Overall, it sounds like the numbers are very good, he said, though I suspect you're about to tell me why they're not good enough.
The dwarf and the halfling glanced at each other and then turned back to Handor with the same simpering smile plastered across their faces.
We prefer to say there's still more opportunity, sire, said Bags.
Oh, lots more,
agreed Ortson, whose enthusiasm was generally proportional to his intemperance.
There's growth on the wall, to be sure, but we've still yet to see the hiring and purchases that really move an economy, said Goldson.
and the taxman is taking money right out of the hands of businesses who would spend it on jobs, sire, said Bags. It's preventing the prosperity that the wall has enjoyed from spreading to the common man, said Goldson.
Handor rested his cheek on his hand.
Somehow, something always is. Think of it this way, Majesty.
Bags set a glass in front of himself and pointed to it.
The wall expects a certain amount of performance out of us, correct? Meeting projections and raising shareholder value, and the like.
He started pouring from a bottle of white gilled red.
We are doing well at the moment. The gold is flowing in. But the wall expected that, said Goldson.
Bags nodded.
Exactly. Until we exceed expectations, we'll have no funds to give raises or hire new workers. Now, if the Gilton were to flow in a bit faster, because of a tax cut, for example...
The halfling tipped the bottle up and poured the rest of it out, allowing some of the wine to spill over the edge.
Then we would have the funds to spare for the people. If we truly want to help the people, our cups must run over, so to speak.
Oh, I never liked trickle-down economics,
said Ortson, watching the crimson wine drip down the glass.
It implies that there is a leak somewhere.
Get a hold of yourself, Weaver,
Goldson snapped. The king ignored the guildmaster. It seems to me, he said to Goldson and Bags, that your problem is that you've too large a cup. However, proclaiming a tax hike could help investors with their unrealistic expectations. Bags blanched.
But, sire, we speak only of concern for the people.
Then hire more of them, snarled Handor, or donate to the temples of Fulgen and Oppo.
If only we could, sire,
simpered Goldson.
But that would hurt our profits, and thus our stock price. And our primary responsibility is to our shareholders, added Bags. As we said, the wall has expectations.
Well, gentlemen, it is an enviable thing to be afforded concern for the people with no responsibility to them, said Handor, settling back in his seat. He sipped at his glass of spirits. You and your shareholders are doing better than most of my subjects.
Perhaps, sire, but we don't know how long that will last,
Goldson confessed.
It's true that our industry has seen growth since many of the Freedland's non-combatant paper carriers returned to the wilds, said Bags. For now,
Goldson raised a hand,
with all of those Shadowkin getting their papers revoked or turning them in, there's money to be made at the moment. But the orcs and goblins won't last more than a few years. If that,
said Bags.
And even in the short term, it's not enough to drive hiring. The Shadowkin leaving the NPC program may be driving good pillage quest loot cycles, but we can't scale that up.
So you're saying it's not sustainable, said Handor.
We're saying that to really grow the economy again, the professional heroics industry needs a sudden increase in revenue or a sudden drop in expenses, such as a cut in our taxes, said Goldson.
That cannot happen, Mr. Goldson, said Handor. I suggest you look elsewhere for a sudden source of revenue. Perhaps your heroes could finally get around to killing the Dragon of Windspar. At the mention of the dragon, Weaver Ortson sprayed a mouthful of wine across the cherrywood table.
But, sire,
the fat man sputtered,
nobody has slain a dragon since the last age.
Even if someone could slay the monster, it wouldn't do much good,
said Bags, grimacing as he cleaned the guildmaster's wine from his spectacles.
Investors consider shares of the dragon's hoard as good as gold. While it may be a boon to some firms if all that equity was suddenly liquid, it wouldn't add much to the bottom line. No,
said Goldson, nodding.
We need a new threat, something more dangerous than the Red Horde. Anything less won't capture enough loot to drive the heroics business forward.
It almost sounds like you're wishing calamity on the people you're so concerned about, said Andor.
Oh, not at all, sire,
said Goldson.
We're wishing a near miss on them, said Bags. A threat of calamity stopped by our fine heroes just before it harms the Freedlands.
and just after we've cashed in, said Goldson. Ah, but we cannot count on such a boon coming any time soon. Barring another opportunity like Bloodroot, I'm afraid we must seek ways to cut expenses, said Bags. We were hoping by about 3%.
Handor pursed his lips. The mention of the Gizvarda tribe brought some unfinished business to mind.
Speaking of Bloodroot and the Red Horde, have we tied up all the loose ends after the Elven marbles?
Goldson and Bags exchanged concerned looks. Johann's grin seemed somehow diminished, if only by a fraction.
Almost, Your Majesty, said Bags.
Handor scowled. And by almost, you mean to say that you haven't tracked down those rubes from the Heroes Guild? Ortson feigned a cough.
Formerly of the Heroes Guild,
he interjected. Gorm Ingerson may be washed up, but he's no rube, sire, said Johann. On the contrary, he's quite dangerous. Especially given what he knows, said Handor dryly. Yes, sire, quite so, said the paladin.
Nobody questions the threat Ingerson poses, agreed Bags, but we are in a difficult situation. As you know, the Pyrebeard and his cohorts intercepted one of our agents last year.
Goldson nodded.
They already have too much evidence of our company's involvement with the unpleasantness at Bloodroot. Which is why we've had to take extra precautions when hiring problem-solving specialists, said Bags. We can't create another paper trail.
What we can't have, gentlemen, is continued excuses, growled the king. I don't want to hear about your recruiting practices. I want to hear that Gorm Ingerson and company are dead.
You will, Majesty,
said Bags.
Have faith, sire, said Goldson. We're sparing no expense to see the matter resolved.
Good, said Handor. Once that unpleasantness is behind us, we can turn our attention back to our mutual success.
I'll drink to that,
Bags raised his glass.
And I'll drink too,
said Ortson, slurring the obvious. To what? Asked Johann.
To just about anything, it seems,
grumbled Goldson. Ha-ha! Johann's laughter was like a trumpet as he raised a goblet of wine. To success, said Handor, holding up his tumbler.